Good morning, welcome to the Live Sense Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning from 11 until 12. You've got Julian Paul here, live in the studio as usual, of course. Later in this hour, we'll be talking to our PG. We have a guest speaker this week, and indeed every fourth Saturday of the month. It's Chris Dale, and he's going to be talking about deep fried food banned in new plans for school dinners. If you tune in regularly, you'll know we have guest speakers most weeks. So next week, and indeed every first Saturday of the month, our guest speaker is Phil Muffett from the Mexbert and Swinton Astronomical Society. And on that note, just a reminder that tomorrow, the 26th of July, they've got an event at their J.A. Jones Observatory up near Hoover, where you can view the sun safely from 11 o'clock in the morning till 3 p.m. in the afternoon. You'll get the opportunity to view our local star with a variety of instruments in safety and comfort. Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society members will be there to help with questions and general astronomical interests and stuff. And best of all, it's free. So go to the J.A. Jones Observatory at Hoover. It's Leebrook Lane. That's Rotherham S627SH. Or just check out Mexbert and Swinton Astronomical Society or www.msas.org.uk for all you need to know. Next up, Paul.
Yes, you may have noticed in your garden butterflies. We have, haven't we?
We have. Definitely. Indeed.
So anyway, it's the annual UK Big Butterfly Count, which started Friday, 17th of July, and finishes on Sunday, the 9th of August, 2026. So help assess the health of our environment by counting the amount and type of butterflies and day flying moths to see in a 15-minute period. So if you want more help on how you would do that, go to www.bigbutterflycount.org.
And elsewhere in the science news this week, as wildfires consume swathes of Europe, the US and Canada, firefighters are struggling to cope due to the number of blazes breaking out simultaneously. But towns and cities across the UK have also been cloaked in smoke, and farmers have lost hundreds of thousands of pounds to crop fires and extreme weather turns the country into a tinderbox. Fire experts warn that Britain's heatwave now breached a so-called 30-30-30 threshold at which fires become hard to control, and that 30-30-30 means above 30 degrees Celsius, under 30% humidity, and winds over 30 kilometres an hour.
Yes, there's a fire in the Cairngorms at the moment. They've been fighting that for 10 days, I do believe. Right, the extreme heat of the past few weeks has also been devastating for nature, not least the UK's bee populations, according to the charity Bug Life. It has received reports of colonies dying out as the insects struggle to find food and water. Paul Heverington, Communications Director for the Bug Life charity, recommended putting out shallow dishes of water, which the bees should be able to access without drowning. We've had to save a few.
We've saved a few.
Yes. He also suggested deadheading flowers to encourage them to reflower, and being more selective with which plants you grow, highlighting Mediterranean plants used to dry weather, such as fennel and lavender, which can help the insects through the hottest part of the year. We was watching last night the programme. It was the RHS Sandringham, wasn't it?
It was. Well, it was Gardener's World, I think.
But it was all about, they've changed the tack, haven't they?
Oh, I think they have. It's all about how can you, carry on growing things in these uncertain conditions when it's often hotter, sometimes drier, but sometimes wetter, you know. It's all about sustainability.
And pollinators.
Oh, big up on pollinators.
Yes.
Yeah, very interesting. So, another interesting one in the news this week. When you put leftovers outside the house for collection, if you do, what do you think you are doing? Getting rid of waste or giving away a valuable resource that could be used right on your doorstep? So, for the founders of an award-winning community compost business in Wales, and I know it's exactly where Stephen Sangeeta live as well in Wales, they own Sheffield Live, of course, it's a no-brainer that the second answer is the correct one for them. So Steph Robinson and Finn Jordeo of Crew Compostio collect food waste from cafes and businesses who pay them and convert it into peat-free compost, which is then used by the community. Local growers then take that compost, grow food that goes back to the cafes, Cafes serve it, waste comes back to us, and we turn it back into compost, says Steph. Once ready, it is available on a pay-what-you-can-afford basis, and all stays within the community within Wales. And I can't pronounce where they live because it's too difficult.
That reminds me that when we was in Scotland a couple of weeks ago, they also had a similar thing at the side of the road where you could put your food waste into alongside other
Maybe
bins.
England's a little bit behind, yeah. So next up, Paul.
Ah.
Oh, no. We've, no. Oh, no. Right, okay.
Nobody's name.
Oh, brilliant. The joy of live radio, eh? So, meanwhile, a 3D printed flow battery created by a team at Queen's University Belfast has been hailed as a breakthrough in renewable energy technology. Flow batteries, which are energy storage systems, are typically made using vanadium, but the 3D printed model uses iron, which is far easier to source.
Ooh. Elsewhere in the news, astronomers have described their discovery of four new hidden white dwarf stars called Local to Earth as a surprise. The University of Warwick team used the Hubble Space Telescope to pinpoint the small, dim stars orbiting in double systems within 65 light years of Earth. The four white dwarf stars in this nearby region of space each have larger and brighter red dwarf companions that had previously concealed them. University of Warwick research fellow Dr. Mayro O'Brien said, "Nearby isolated white dwarfs are usually easy to find, but we couldn't see these four stars directly in visible wavelengths because of their red dwarf companions were drowning out their light. It is a reminder that even in our own cosmic neighbourhood, we can still find surprises if we look in the right way, at the right wavelengths. One of the stellar binaries, known as G203-47, is now officially the ninth closest white dwarf to the sun."
Indeed, wow. And hopefully Paul's now going to get me up a little story about camels. Ooh. Struggling in the heat. Chris sent this in, and of course we'll be talking to Chris later in this show. So it says, even camels can't cope. Africa's ships of the desert hit by rising temperatures. And it says that camels are famously known as the ships of the desert, but even these hardy animals are not being spared from the extremes of rising temperatures in Africa. The Afar region of northeastern Ethiopia is one of the hottest and driest places on earth, where nomads often lead camel caravans carrying salt through the desert. "I could see my camels suffering from extreme heat," Ali Umar, a camel herder from Samarra in Afar, told the BBC. "They get blisters on their feet, their eyes become watery, and the hot sand burns their skin and eats up their hair when they are sitting down." Oh my word. And he owns about 500 camels, and he said, "Within the past month, I've lost 8 camel calves because of the extreme heat. It has become much more intense and difficult. Even the wind, which used to bring cool air, now carries heat." Adding he had noticed these drastic changes in temperatures in recent years. And he's not alone in his observations. Scientists, animal welfare workers and various studies all mention stress, fatigue, dehydration, disease prevalence as direct impacts of extreme heat. And also that higher temperature also indirectly makes camels suffer by causing severe loss of water, vegetation and reduced shaded areas. So it seems everybody's suffering as well. So finally, before we talk to RPG, very quickly, this was in the RHS magazine, July magazine. It said, "Look and listen for shrews." It says, "Tune into these tiny, fast-living predators. Shrews are frequent small mammal visitors to our gardens. There are 3 species in the UK, common pygmy and water shrews. But it's the common shrew, Sorex araneus, that gardeners are most likely to see. Listen for them in summer when their high-pitched squeaks might be heard among your plants while you're quite relaxed in your garden. Despite being only 5 to 8 centimetres in length, with a 2 to 4 centimetre long tail and weighing no more than 5 to 14 grams, common shrews are feisty creatures, and the high-pitched noises usually indicate they are having a row over territory. So common shrews are an essential part of garden ecosystems. They have dark brown fur, tiny eyes, very small ears, and a tail only half the length of the body. With their keen sense of smell, they actively sniff with their long pointy noses in the undergrowth, hunting for grubs, pupae, spiders and earthworms. These little creatures are always hungry, being active year-round, day and night. They must eat 80 to 90% of their body weight every day to survive. They can act as primary predator in our gardens, keeping slug, snail and caterpillar populations down. And with a super-fast metabolism, shrews have a short lifespan of only a year, but produce 3 to 4 litters of about 6 young. To attract and spot shrews, leave parts of your lawn with tall grass and plant a mix of flowers to draw in different invertebrates that in turn will attract this spirited creature into hunting your garden. So that's it. Look out for some shrews. Yes, they're looking around because an RHS article just talked about saying look and listen for shrews, and like bats, common shrews use ultrasonic clicks for navigation. All interesting stuff, eh? If you just tuned in, of course, listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning from 11 until 12. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Good morning. Sounding loud and clear, thankfully.
Good-o.
So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
Oh, a couple of bits, but one I mentioned on the bees front, you know, you're saying about what we could do to help out. One of the suggestions is if you've got a garden, get yourself a small pond, a very small pond, and put some flowering plants around the pond because it retains more moisture in the nectar that the bees collect.
Oh, clever.
Get food and a drink together.
Get you, Paul.
Yeah, so I thought that's a good bit of advice that we've got a couple of pools that are about sort of half a barrel size each and some fountain sprays in them. So a lot of wildlife is attracted. Downside of that is I'm starting to get polka dot legs from something eating me by degrees.
Oh,
there's always
dear.
A downside as well, isn't there?
There is.
So apart from that, in the news, I was sort of looking at how trends can throw up different things. And I don't know if you guys have come across a new drink sort of trend, which is called Buzz Balls. And I think if you go into a lot of places that sell drinks, this is a sort of an item which is about the size of a cricket ball with a sort of a drinking straw built in, but it's for cocktails. So you might think you want a cool drink in this weather, so looking at these, they were sold initially I think on the basis that the packaging, which is a round plastic ball, apart from the top, which is an aluminium cap, which is firmly affixed to the plastic. And originally they were promoted as being recyclable. But it's been pointed out in the UK that it doesn't really conform to our recycling requirements, because it's not easy to detach the aluminium cap from the plastic base. So it's a great idea for a lot of people. It's a clean way to pick up these drinks. It's a trend that's getting, they're saying that it's taking Generation Z by storm, and they thought they were doing well at... The buzz ball can't be recycled, as it's got PET plastic ball that can't be separated from the aluminium lid. And that's on advice from the environmental action body called WRAP, or RAP. And they said this is a case that they see as a shocking act of greenwashing, which is to try and sell something and say that it's recyclable just because it gives it more credence with people believing that they've got something that's doing good. So BuzzBall's been, they blamed a website error for claiming that recycling, and that was due to a relationship to a US-only scheme called TerraCycle. But it didn't comment on that now in things like their frequently asked questions. So if you buy BuzzBall's, fine, enjoy your drink, but you can't really throw it into the sort of recycling waste. It becomes general waste and again causes an ongoing problem. So I say that it's been voted in the Grocer, the British magazine, the biggest alcohol, one of the biggest alcohol brands of 2026. So I say you'll spot them once you know about them, in bright colours. I say a plastic ball about the size of a cricket ball. It's got an aluminium foil lid on the top. It was a company that was founded by a teacher called Merrily Kick. And that was then sold on to a company called Sazerac, whose chief exec is Jake Wenz. They bought it in 2024. So it's been heavily marketed, and they said that their mission statement, which was on the BBC, which was deleted after the BBC contacted the company about the recycling story. But they say that the TerraCycle system involves consumers collecting packaging and sending it to be recycled, but only runs in the United States. So a great trend, and I don't know if you came across it, but
No, not at all. So that's a new one on me, Paul. But I also, looking at the article, it also says that actually the reason they're so popular is because they're strong in alcohol and relatively cheap for the amount of alcohol. So that's not good on another level, is it?
Yeah, I say it's a temptation, and I think this weather again, just a gentle warning about taking it on a cold beer or alcohol to counter the heat. It's not always the best thing to do. So a bit of good clean water, if you can find that in the UK at the moment,
yeah,
is well worth it. So it's just I think one of those confusions, and I know. A couple of years ago, I started to notice the small cylinders that laughing gas came in.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It was used as a propellant, and all of a sudden it became a craze among younger people to go out partying and inhale the laughing gas. And that started off just on the roadside, outside where I live, and I noticed a string of these little bottles appearing, and thought,
"They sort of look like party poppers, don't they?"
Yeah, it's a little silver kind of bottle shape, pointed end, and they start to appear everywhere. So I think you know, if you look around on the roadsides and things, you're sure to see some of the buzz ball sort of debris appearing. And hopefully it doesn't go down the same route, because I think with the sort of laughing gas, the next thing you saw was the large industrial containers that they use for making things like whipped cream. It is used to sort of work on that. So great fun, but you know, beware of what you're doing, and it is impacting the environment. So maybe the company can think about the way they put together their package. But that's the kind of news that appealed to me this week or so. And then looking at the problems of the wildfires that are happening, and you know, it's a terrible downside. I saw that in the south of England, a previous wildfire had decimated the local sand lizard population, and this last week they were taking some sand lizards that they'd bred in captivity back to the spot that they used to survive in. And it's a downward south facing slope, a very gentle slope, which is ideal for them. And the people there said they were very surprised that in the limited amount of time since it was decimated, it had come back. So a lot of heathers and gorse and things were starting to create the environment, which is ideal for the sand lizards, and they put them out. And then the rider at the end of that was to say, well, we really hope that it'll stay okay and they can thrive again and replace the thing, but you've got to be wary about the heat. So the flip side of that caught my attention was that apparently the heat wave has been revealing lots of lost archaeological sites across Wales, as you mentioned, Wales.
Oh, well, I couldn't. It's McClinlith or something, Powys, but I couldn't pronounce the area. Yeah. But Wales again in the news then.
Yeah, so this is it's revealed in the landscape because it's dried the grass and the crops out. The outline of a Roman fort in Conway has been sort of collecting details of that so they can go and address it. It's called the Caerhun, I think it's Caerhun, Roman fort in Conway. And they say that lost archaeological sites have emerged as the grasslands across Wales have dried out through the prolonged heat. And they say they've only seen about 5% of the average rainfall for July. And it's much drier than usual April to June. So it really has sort of started to dry everything out and expose a lot of architectural sort of remains amongst the landscape. So archaeologists are sort of looking at that. The Royal Commission on Ancient and Historical Monuments of Wales are trying to log as many of these things as they can. They're saying that crop marks made by vegetation drawing on better nutrients and water, supplies trapped in long-gone fortification ditches, that leads to green growth there that stands out, but as they disappear quickly once the weather conditions change, it's a race against time to try and log a lot of these archaeological sites.
Wow, how interesting.
Yeah, I think it's amazing how you look in the news and you'll see stories that have got aspects in probably a positive and negative side of things. And I was amazed looking at the news who were publishing the extent of the wildfires across Europe. And I think it really is a serious issue for Europe. And I think I mentioned last week about President Trump wanting to put tariffs on Canada because the pollution that was coming across the border from their wildfires. Just another excuse, I think, for the tariffs, because I think he's applied those again across the world. Raking in some money for the American economy. But, I think that's the kind of things that I was sort of looking at. And another thing that caught my eye was about how ADHD, attention deficit disorder, has rewired the workplace. And they're saying this is the kind of thing that it means for employers. So a large grocery chain was taken to the employment tribunal by an employee who says that going through the tribunal almost took over his life. It was all he could think about for 18 months. He'd been the deputy store manager who told his bosses that he'd been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and was called to a disciplinary meeting after he broke the company's rules for using equipment that they hadn't been trained to use, and subsequently he was dismissed for gross misconduct. But the appeal was... he was successful with his appeal and the decision. Then he was offered a lower paid role, which he rejected, and took his case to tribunal again, and eventually was awarded a significant sum, £45,000, when they found his former employers hadn't fully taken his ADHD diagnosis into account during the disciplinary process. And it's kind of one of the things that struck me in the real groundswell, I think, of people, and they cite post-COVID, a lot of young people are being diagnosed as ADHD or with certain sort of mental issues linked to the way that they dealt with things like COVID. That's rolling forward into the workplace, and it's really, he said that a lot of the time his managers said that he didn't show any remorse, but he said that realistically, in the case of his ADHD, he didn't really show a lot of emotions. So he, within himself, could be either incredibly happy, angry, upset or remorseful, but his facial expression and tone of voice didn't actually transmit that. So it's a real difficulty, I think, of being fair if generally people don't understand and sometimes aren't diagnosed until they're challenged in some way, and that forces a diagnosis through one route or another. So it's quite a difficulty, I think, that troubles with mental health are really sort of being pushed towards younger people. So a very interesting story. It's on the BBC website if you want to follow it up and read it in a bit more detail. But they say that neurodivergence, which is the kind of catch-all label for these various issues, is on the increase, and we really ought to be more aware and looking to be able to deal with that. So kind of an interesting one, and I think realistically on the news, a lot of things, the kind of last thing is something that's close to home, and it's an old chestnut, but potholes. Right outside my house, there was a pothole, and it was incredibly noisy because I live on the ring road, and the degree of traffic that's passing with heavy goods for things like just-in-time deliveries, and we're on the circuit which takes things out towards Attercliffe, so steel scrap, large vehicles for lots of different things going over. So I went onto the Sheffield Government website, the local council, where they've got a reporting plate, I put in a report about this, and realistically, what they say is, we won't really reply to you. We'll acknowledge that you sent in that. If you care to keep an eye on your pothole, you may see some yellow markings around it occur, because we'll pass on this information to the company who look after potholes for us. Scoop forward to the local elections, and I spoke to my local councillor, Ben Miskell, and said, this is absolutely terrible. It doesn't just affect me, it affects people for sort of 100 yards up the street, because the frequency of this clatter and noise. So I think it was 5 weeks after that, he got back to me and said he'd written to the chief executive of Yorkshire Water, because it was their manhole cover that needed fixing. Scoop forward another 4 or 5 weeks, and a neighbour of mine who'd got some experience of roadworks and dealing with things managed to get in touch with Yorkshire Water. And later on that day, a small lorry appeared, and a man dumped a bag of asphalt into the manhole cover, tamped it down, and went off. So we're kind of waiting to see what happens. So potholes is really difficult. They rely an awful lot on people having smartphones with cameras, with the ability to record noise, but the thing is, you have to provide overwhelming evidence of these issues, really, to stir up some kind of response. So potholes is a problem, and the system really isn't robust in terms of dealing with them. And I know the same thing happens with our pavements. There was talk about a coordinated response to people who dig up for services, so gas, electric, water. If they're running supplies to houses, we'll often dig up the same stretch of pavement 3 or 4 times, so that there's no coordination to say, look, you know, if you're going to put services in, try and get together and fix a date where you can do all three things and reduce the amount of damage. So that's really why I chose my track.
I know. Well, I was going to say, Paul, what you need to do is live in Blackpool, because ages ago I read an article that said they've got the least number of potholes in the country or something. Yes. So, but actually, I know why you've chosen this song now, but it talks about Blackburn, Lancashire, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And the Albert Hall, by the way.
And the Albert Hall as well. The Albert Hall struggling with the heat, with the problems, tuning the organs and things like that.
Yeah,
it's affecting them. It's not air conditioned, I don't think, either. So
it is, but I think on a domestic front, potholes causing lots of damage and lots of people getting annoyed.
And noise pollution, Paul.
Well, and the accountability for it, that's the problem. So you have a real difficult task, actually, narrowing down who is responsible and trying to promote some action.
Paul.
That's why I picked A Day in the Life.
By the Beatles.
Paul, just before you go, I know the mayor's been having a good old grap about potholes as well, hasn't he?
Yes, I say that there's an awful lot of talk about it, and most people will have a story of potholes. And, you know, I can look along the ring road and see the remains of people's suspensions that have broken.
So it is.
And if you drive a car these days and it damages a tyre, it's a significant expense.
Yeah. We've been driving around avoiding some big ones at the moment, really massive ones.
There are some awful ones, and so much of it is just regular road surface maintenance that hasn't been done.
Yeah.
Indeed. Well, here we go with the Beatles from Sergeant Pepper's.
Good-o.
Bye-bye, Paul. We'll speak with you. Glory's Rockshire 1-3. Bye-bye.
Look forward to it. Bye. Bye.
Thank you.
A Day in the Life there from the Beatles. And we played that because RPG was talking about the situation with potholes in Sheffield. I'm sure Sheffield's not the only place. We've just tuned in and listened to the Live Sounds radio show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. We should have Chris Dale on the line. Good morning, Chris.
Morning, everybody. Good. Is everybody well?
We are indeed. Thanks for joining us, good. Chris, yet again. We brought you in there on Vagabond. The track is called Pretty Boy, but they sing, I'm not a pretty boy.
Yeah, well, that's obviously what you think of me.
Oh, no.
It was interesting what PG was saying about the potholes, because we've just come back from the Netherlands and we drove around the Netherlands and we didn't see a single pothole.
It's interesting, isn't it? Different policies. Am I right, Chris? Can you remember about Blackpool? They had a different PFI contract, maybe. I'm not sure. They had a different way of dealing with potholes. You know?
No, but, I don't.
Yeah.
Don't know about that.
No, but it's interesting, isn't it? Never mind, but you're here today to talk about deep fried food being banned in schools.
Yeah, and high sugar items being restricted as well under new plans to overhaul school dinners. And I'd like to think this is down to our 5-year campaign on getting people to eat more healthy, it's unlikely.
Is it really 5 years, Chris?
It is.
It probably is, isn't it? Yeah, we. I think you started talking about food additives. That was where we started, wasn't it? What's in ultra-processed food? And, I mean, it just never stops, does it, Chris?
Oh, amazing. So, this week, normally I talk about stuff and I leave people feeling really depressed and miserable. But, actually, I've got a couple of good news stories this week. So, under government proposals, fruit will replace sugar-laden treats for the majority of school week, and schools will no longer be allowed to offer unhealthy grab-and-go options like sausage rolls and pizzas every day. The Association of School and College Leaders said it supported improving the quality of school food and that cutting unhealthy food from school menus was welcome and long overdue. Just incidentally, on the back of that, Reform UK issued a statement saying and accused the government of trying to micromanage people's lives, but I'll get on to that a little bit later. The Department for Education, which is the DfE, says The changes will mean millions of children will get healthier and more nutritious meals at school every day. And the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, called the changes the most ambitious overhaul of school food in a generation. She said every child deserves to have delicious, nutritious food at school, and that gives them energy to concentrate, learn, and thrive. And we've spoken about this before, but currently more than one in three children leave primary school overweight or obese. And while tooth decay from high sugar diets is the leading cause of hospital admissions for children aged between 5 and 9. And we did a whole program on that, didn't we?
We did, yeah.
About that. So under the new rules, sweetened desserts will be limited to once a week, and more fruit, vegetables and whole grains will need to be added to the school dinner menus. And these are the first changes to the food standards for 10 years. And the plans to introduce this were actually delayed due to the pandemic. And they will apply to primary and secondary schools across England as part of the efforts to improve health, children's health and nutrition. Early Education Minister Olivia Bailey hopes the plans will kickstart a transformation of food school. The government hopes to reduce sugar, increase fibre and get rid of some really unhealthy foods like deep fat fried food. Schools will also be told to publish menus online while stressing that the plans don't need to cost more. And this is from Olivia Bailey. She says, I don't think healthier food has to be more expensive food for schools. And I've put a note there because one of the things that we've discovered on the Live Science Show is that actually trying to eat healthier is more expensive.
Yeah.
Because ultra-processed food, which is high in fat, sugar and salt, is a lot cheaper to produce in factories than it is to eat healthily. So when she says, I don't think healthier food has to be more expensive, well, I think schools might actually struggle with this, but we'll see what happens over the next year or so. Now, secondary schools will have a phased approach for some of these changes, and this is to give them enough time to develop recipes, update menus, and train staff. And the school food standards will be announced in September of this year and come into force September next year. And also, all new schools that are being built today, none of them will have deep fat fryers in the kitchen. They'll be replaced by ovens. And this is a new DfE building specification. Now, on top of all this, there's going to be a robust enforcement system to check that schools are following the new standards, including monitoring schools' compliance to the menus. Previous school standards introduced in 2015 also included fruit vegetable requirements and limiting sugars in drinks, with an emphasis on whole grain instead of refined carbonates like white bread and pasta. Sorry, carbohydrates like white bread and pasta. But some head teachers have raised concern that these are not always being followed due to the costs. And alongside these standards, any child in England whose parents receive universal credit will be able to claim free school meals from September 2026. And this would allow something in the order of 500,000 additional children to be eligible for healthy meals. Schools, and this was just a bit of research that I did, schools are currently given £2.61 to fund each school free meal. But a 2025 survey suggested that the real cost of delivering school meals was approximately £3.45, which is roughly 80p more. Now, I did speak to a head teacher, and one of the head teachers told me at their school that they do provide additional money to the kitchen to provide better standard of food. So the schools are actually subsidising this. There are examples of the schools subsidising the meals as well.
Very interesting, Chris.
Yeah. Well, I think it's it's the absolute right thing to be doing this in schools and trying to educate children to eat much more healthier. It's got to be a successful thing to do in the long run.
If you think about it, Chris, I'm sure when you were at school, home economics was a subject, and I did it, and you learnt to cook and iron, and you know, boys and girls alike.
Yeah.
And that got sort of taken off the syllabus. I'm not personally sure why, but that we've paid the price for that, because a lot of kids, I think, as you're going to go on to say, don't know where food comes from or how to cook it.
Yeah. Well, they do have domestic science rooms and cookery rooms in secondary schools now, and that's making a comeback because I think people are recognising the importance. But like you say, that's not the case in every single school, and it generally is an option rather than a compulsory thing to do. But some really good news, and something which is local to Sheffield, is that a primary school in Sheffield has become the first in Yorkshire to be recognised for meeting the highest standards in school meals and promoting healthy eating. So big up, Waterthorpe Infant School is just one of seven schools in England that has been given the Food for Life Gold Award.
Yay.
I didn't know there was one. Wow. Yay!
Yay! The accolade. Get the bells out. I can't find them.
The accolade is given to schools that meet strict standards on healthy eating, sustainably sourced food, and support for local food producers. So head teacher Shelley Appleby, my new superhero, said understanding food and where it comes from are skills that children need for life. So we think it's just as important to learn about food as it is to read and write. More than 700 schools and 80 nurseries in England are taking part in the Food for Life programme, which is run by the food and farming charity, the Soil Association. A Food for Life award at any level demonstrates that a school is embedding a whole school approach to food and nutrition, and the Gold Award shows a commitment and passion throughout the school and into the community and beyond. The head teacher told us that the school, which has 32% free school meals take up, offered a progressive approach during lunch to ensure children enjoyed the experience. She says, we keep the dining hall really quiet. In reception, children will carry a flight tray themselves, line up, get their own dinner, and then find somewhere to sit themselves. But in years one and two, they have proper plates and serve themselves the dinner. And lovely pupil Elsie, who's age seven, said her favourite school lunch was winner, winner, chicken dinner. And she enjoyed chatting with friends while she ate.
That's an important point, Chris, as well, isn't it? A lot of children now do not know how to sit at a table and eat.
Don't know how to use a knife and fork. Don't know how to use a knife and fork.
So that important point, that important point about chatting with your friends over your lunch.
Absolutely. I think they've done absolutely amazing at Waterthorpe Infant School. And then the other thing is, staff said stickers and reward systems had encouraged children to make healthy choices and to eat more fruit and vegetables. The school also has an allotment where they grow pumpkins, beetroot, tomatoes, and also alongside herbs like mint and coriander. And this has given the children an insight into where their food comes from. So Suzanne Marriott, the school's eco leader, said sometimes our children go to the supermarket and think that's where potatoes and carrots come from. So they've been amazed when they see the plants grow. They just can't believe it's something that they've grown themselves. Mm. And actually, there are quite a number of schools doing that now. And I'm actually working with a school in Derby that does exactly this, and the children grow the food themselves and then they cook the vegetables that they grow so they can eat them.
Wow. Yeah.
Other initiatives that have helped the school reach a gold standard include cooking clubs, food themed assemblies, and recipe cards for parents. And the school has also been supported with their meals offer through Sheffield City Council's Eat Smart programme, which might be something that we look at another time. So Lisa Aldwin, who's the Sheffield City Council's Eat Smart Programme Manager, said the school has shown a fantastic level of commitment and the award has inspired the whole school community. So can we give a big applause to Waterthorpe Infant School?
Yay! Woo! Paul, get the bells. No, he hasn't called. But a great story, Chris, but it's great on lots of levels, isn't it? You know, just about growing... schools having little allotments to teach people how to grow food and that whole process from garden to plate.
Yeah, it is fantastic. And actually the children, if you give them the right incentives, they become more engaged in it. So in particular, if a child at a mealtime chooses to have vegetables and fruit or something like that, they can be given a sticker that says, gold star, I've eaten healthily today. And then if they get sort of 10 gold stars, they can get a little small award from the school. Or they might get a certificate of assembly, something like that. So it's constantly rewarding them for making good choices. So going back to, the reform comment saying that we're interfering in people's lives, over the years that we've done this radio show, we've talked about the impact on children and the impact on children from poorer communities as well. And the impact on them is so much more significant, isn't it, than people from middle class and wealthier backgrounds. So I just cannot see anything wrong with these initiatives. I think they're just absolutely fantastic.
Yes. Go on, Chris. Sorry.
No, I would just say we've been speaking about this for years now, haven't we? So it's really good to be able to share something that's really positive.
Yes, excellent, Chris. All I was going to say is what's interesting for a lot of children, you're saying they're obese and they've got tooth decay and things like that. Often they're malnourished as well. They're suffering from lack of nutrition because a lot of the foods they're eating have got no nutritional value. They're just full of chemicals, And these are the foods that are often, as you say, cheaper than buying and making fresh foods. So I think it's a really big issue for our time, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, if they have breakfast clubs in school as well, particularly for children from, let's say poorer families. So if children can eat in the morning and then have a very healthy lunch, it helps them to learn and to be able to concentrate and things like that. And that's just as important as well.
Yeah, because that's been a big issue, hasn't it? A lot of children coming to school, maybe with a bag of crisps or less than that. You can't concentrate and learn with no food inside you. So... brilliant.
Absolutely.
Great stuff, as always, Chris.
Thank you. And what song have you chosen?
Oh, well, we struggled, didn't we, to find something that was related to fry or fried foods or something like that. We were going to play that track, that cheeseburger song that your American friend sent in for us, but we found Oily Way by Gong. I know prog rock's not your thing, Chris, but Oily Way. So this is against, deep fried food and really unhealthy food in schools.
That's brilliant. Lovely to talk to you both.
Fantastic, Chris. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Chris. Bye-bye.
Bye.
mysteries, angels, eggs, and octoductors, radio gnome and love projectors. Then he'll point up in the sky, and you will see the teapots flying. Down the oily way you slide, through the inner space you ride. Lots and lots of pothead pixies riding down in teapot taxis. On the planet gone, they say, if everything goes wrong today, fill your teapot up with tea, come and take a ride with me.
Track there, Oily Way by Gong. Why do we play that? Because we're talking to Chris Dale about new school dinner regulations, I guess. Deep fried food will be banned and high sugar items restricted in schools in England under new plans to overhaul school dinners. It'll come into force, is it, in September this year? And then the rules will be finalised and then it'll come into practice a year later in 2027. Some might say that's too late to wait, but when one in three children leave primary school overweight or obese, and tooth decay from high sugar diets is the leading cause of hospital admissions for children aged between 5 and 9. Shocking stuff, eh? We are fast coming to the end, though, of this week's Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Join us every Saturday morning live from 11 till 12, talking about science in all its different forms. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.